Is it possible to work with bureaucracy to bring about the social changes we want to see? Can art be part of urban life? I am Becca Lewis, and this is the Shift the Story podcast, where we practice shifting the story, not just ours, but the worldview. And that is what my guest, Kozer Razvi, does. She believes government can work for social benefit, and she demonstrates what that looks like every day in her work and in her life. I heard Kozer speak at Creative Mornings in Cleveland and was moved by both her business and her personal message. I think you will be too. Oh, sometimes you can't control the noise background. In this case, it was the local Air Force base deciding to fly directly over my house during this interview. I guess it was their way of shifting the story. When we started talking, I was saying I was feeling as if I was, might not have said it out loud, but I'm kind of starstruck by you, and I know you're probably embarrassed by me saying that. But when I heard you speak at Creative Mornings, I just sat there rooted to my chair, and I've heard so many speakers for so many years, and you, your talk, it was about fantasy, I know, but it was so personal and so moving that I just couldn't believe that it was happening.
Wow, thank you. That is a huge compliment.
Well, it's really true, and I know I'm not alone in thinking that. So I'm just so grateful for you saying that you'd say yes. And I could read your bio, but we might take the whole 20 minutes to do it. But the thing that just blew me away is that you have this ability, as you were talking, and then when I read all about you, that you have this ability to take art and collaboration and put it in the public sector. And oh my God, that is just so amazing. So did you always know that you wanted to do that? And do you find it hard or inspiring? What started this whole process?
In terms of work and my work, the funny thing is, you know, I grew up in a big family, so that's kind of where to start. And I have three sisters, and they're really amazing. They're my best friends. And one's a doctor, and one's a filmmaker, and one's an architect who works on sustainability issues now. And I have lots and lots of first cousins, over 25. And my dad was the oldest in this family. And so there was always kind of people coming in and out of this house. And my mom babysat for some of the neighbors sometimes. And so kind of this idea that there's always a community around and there's always people around, and you kind of have to like negotiate your space and make things happen. And was kind of just part of how I grew up. And it was a pretty, you know, it was a fun family in the sense, you know, we'd make up games, we would, you know, go across the street to play with a really great family, the Myers, Lori and Scott Myers, and it was awesome. And, you know, they had a sandbox, we didn't. And it was, you know, we would play and we would build cities actually in that. My sister, that's a filmmaker, she always jokes and she's like, you wanted to be an urban planner since you've been playing in Lori Myers' sandbox, you know? And so I guess that this idea that there are a lot of people around that have to kind of like work together to make things happen is just part of my nature in general. I kind of don't believe in the hero story and, you know, you go it alone, right?
Right.
And then in regards to the part about, you know, how do you infuse art and culture and these kinds of things into the civic space, I think that for me, again, that upbringing of, you know, reading and writing, and at Thanksgiving, we would sometimes do these family skits, and it was kind of always there, right? So literature and art and as a reflection of like what's happening, or for me as a way to kind of process my own understanding, like, oh, I'm working on something and then I happen to read fiction. In fact, I almost only read fiction, which is probably not good. I should start reading more history and biographies and things like that. But it was a way, it's a way just for me to kind of like process and reflect in, on the world. And so, you know, in my daily life, I do these things working with cities and nonprofits and, you know, how can we design them? How can we make them better? How can we make these programs better? How do we solve a problem with a program or a project or a policy? And then this part that, you know, that kind of creative desire, that need to read, to connect. I don't have a lot of barriers in my life. They kind of just all merge. So I think that's what makes it work for me. I don't really see the distinction, you know. I think, too, especially now, you know, I really, really have been thinking about this since this election, which, you know, affected me deeply and a lot of people deeply in different ways. You know, some people are very jubilant and some people are very depressed. And both of those emotions are valid and we have to, you know, appreciate that as humans. Is that, you know, we construct these things. And so the creative process is one of construction. And there's no reason why the systems in which we live in, the cities in which we live in, the policies which we design, we can't deconstruct and reconstruct in a way that's more human, that's more empathetic, that's more adaptable and necessary to what we need.
Wow. I agree with every single thing you said. And I'm just so grateful that you grew up in a big family that taught you all that. Because that is I can't think of anything more needed in the public space than someone that understands that process. And I love that there's so many people who are doing it, but you're doing it in such a visible way that without that, I think we're stuck forever. And we're stuck forever in a way that keeps people separated. And the creative process brings people together, which makes me think of that. You talked about that literary lots that you did in Cleveland, and that was so brilliant. Do you want to tell people a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, absolutely. So literary lots is kind of a passion project of mine in between the work that I do, you know, consulting and working with cities and nonprofits on their projects and programs. At the time in Cleveland, this was a few years ago, there was a lot of work being done by others around vacant lots, and they had a whole series about reimagining spaces and a real enthusiasm to look at vacancy as an asset instead of a deficit. And this is not something that's just for Cleveland, right? It could be Detroit, Youngstown, a lot of these kind of Rust Belt rural states, but even in other places, kind of this idea that, well, just because it's vacant doesn't mean it's useless.
Right.
And that really resonated with me, right? Like this idea that, again, kind of like what we were talking about before, we put value on things. So if the vacant lot does not have value, it does not have value. And if we can reimagine it, if we can redesign it, if we can reuse it, then, you know, it could have more value to us. It could also, you know, visually, aesthetically, physically, economically, however we want to repurpose that space. And so a lot of the work that was being done, you know, great, you know, work in terms of policy about, you know, taking over a lot that's next door to you, making gardens, making community gardens, and all of that. And so, but for me, I had this idea about like, wow, what if we walk past the lot and it was like a story?
Yes.
And you just like walked into this lot and it was really like Dr. Seuss's trees were everywhere, you know, those truffula trees from the Lorax. And what if there were, I don't know, like a huge pirate ship or something from Treasure Island? And so I just kind of started playing with this idea and documenting it. And I brought it to a beautiful artist, Julia Kuo. She's a beautiful person, beautiful art. And I said, hey, Julia, you know, you had done this blog, 100 Days in Cleveland, with these little illustrations. And the illustrations were just so simple and beautiful to me, you know, nothing extravagant, nothing extra, you know, they just really seem to capture the essence of a place. And so I said, hey, I have this idea. Would you maybe do some renderings of this idea? Like, what would this lot look like to you? Because she also has this very whimsical, you know, sense too to her drawings. And so she's like, yeah, I love this idea. Let's do it. And so she created a set of renderings, and then I shopped this idea to the library director, and I was like, hey, you know, I have this idea, and I was thinking about Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs because, you know, Cleveland's a big food town, and it kind of related to this idea of the community gardens and things. And I was like, what if we, you know, we could put these big sandwich boats in these lots and, like, you know, the sales and these meatballs and spaghetti and, you know, tea parties, and people would be reading. And again, that's kind of how I talk and I think, and this enthusiasm. And he was great. He, Felton Thomas at the Cleveland Public Library, he's like, I love it. I think it's great. You know, we don't have a lot of bandwidth to run with it, but we'll support you with it. We'll give you a grant to do it. We'll help you, you know, get funding if you can kind of drive it. I was like, all in. And so that was kind of the genesis of the project. And the framing idea really is that when that books and literature, and especially children's books, and I have, you know, two kids, they're getting older, so they don't read, you know, the picture books anymore, but that these books are, you know, are so fundamental to us, and they really are part of us, and we carry these stories with us as we grow up. Sometimes we recognize it and sometimes we don't, but there really isn't a person who doesn't want to walk into a book, you know, walk into that story. It's why we love books. It's why we love music. It's why we love movies. You know, there's part of us, again, as humans, that want to be taken somewhere else to fantasize, to go. And I was just trying to manifest that in my community.
Well, I agree with you. The story thing, it's in podcast is Shift the Story. So it is all about stories and the stories we want to hear and the stories we want to live. But the phrase that you said, what if, that I love that phrase, not from the standpoint where a lot of people say what if and then they talk about all the negative things that could happen, but what if the imagination taking us into places that we had never done before. And that your enthusiasm carries other people into that what if, I think that's where the magic is, because you could say that to people without that enthusiasm and it wouldn't really ring true to them. So that's what I think one of your biggest gifts is that enthusiasm for that joy of what if imagination, what if we imagined this?
I think the what if question is really an interesting question, and I think it's one we don't ask enough without judgment, right?
Yes.
Right. So like when you said, oh yeah, we ask the what if question, but what if this happens and bad things happen, right?
Right.
Which in my opinion, like the bad things happen like a lot less than the good things. And maybe that's naivete, maybe that's just kind of my general optimism. Maybe it's a Pollyanna-ish worldview, which I have been, you know, called out on that before. But I think that if we ask the what if question and we're open to all of the responses that come to it, and even in the work that I do, you know, I'm working with technology now and data, and I'm trying to bring people together around it to try to create kind of, you know, a culture of citizens working with information so that they can build, you know, so they can know what's going on, so that they can ask questions, so that they can seek responses. And, you know, that what if question is prevalent every day. And it's, to me, it's really more about will, right? Like,
yes,
it's not about the technical work. It's not often about money. It's not. It's really about a choice that we make. And I make this choice to do X or Y. And that's where we falter. First, we don't ask the question and we're not open to the responses. And second, we are not willing to make that choice because we can't, or we're afraid, or, you know, we're not willing to kind of go all the way with it.
I don't think that I could call you, I think people who know you and say that you have a Pollyanna response don't know you very well, because I think you're very practical and down to earth about what you're doing. You're just choosing to say, what if the good can happen instead of what if the bad happens. And I agree with you. Have most of the bad things don't happen. It's the what if good happens if we do this, and that's the focus that we want to take. But I think I'd be remiss if I, and I know I would be remiss if I didn't have you talk a little bit about what brought everybody to tears.
Sure.
At the end of your talk, and it makes me want to cry now. So what you talked about at the end of your talk was, so what if we did something right?
Yeah. So, you know, it was hard for me to put the talk together, you know, in a way that allowed me to also talk about these issues of the election that were pressing on me. And for those of your listeners who weren't at this talk, I'll just kind of quickly summarize it and then jump to the end where you're taking me, Becca. So the talk was about literary lots and kind of how I brought it to fruition and the impact it had on me in terms of me, you know, facing some of my own fears about creating something and putting it out in the world. For me, putting my fantasy of creating this three-dimensional storybook out for people, you know, possibly failing. It was a great success. So that, you know, learning that. And I ended the talk with kind of two ideas. And the first was about, you know, just in general, that when we have fantasies and when we put them out there in the world, it's scary because it's so intimate. You know, fantasy is something that's so intimate to us, right? It's something that we desire. It's something that we want. It's something that we think, you know, it's something magical, maybe. And, you know, so to kind of like put that out there puts us potentially at risk, right, of being rejected, right, or being unloved or being labeled as something we don't want to be. And doing the Literary Lots project really just, you know, gave me some courage and really helped me, you know, put that out there. And so when I ended my talk, I did put up a slide that was early on the week after the election this was, and there was a headline that said, you know, Republican X, Y, and Z, you know, calling for the Muslim registry. And I said to the group that, you know, this is jarring, right? Because this isn't about somebody else. This is about me. You know, I am a Muslim. I grew up in America when I feel like in the late 70s, early 80s, like no one was talking about Muslims. No one really knew who you were. It was just, you know, it just went on. It was a great thing. For me, I love being Muslim. I believe Islam is all about these things that are so essential to our life, you know, community and seeking knowledge and being generous and being kind and being, you know, aware to, you know, being understanding. All of these things that I just feel are, you know, fundamentally me. And so when I have been seeing and hearing these things, it's very, very hard. It's very hard to say like, wow, you know, like this is a statement. This is a rejection of who I am and what I believe in and where's my place, right? And my comment to the group was that the difference though between this is I think that this is a fantasy. That these things, these issues of rejection, this issue of isolation, these issues of putting people on a registry, like I'm hoping that they're fantasy.
Yes.
I hope that they can't become real because our better selves will prevent that, right? Like that to make them real would be of such damage. And the statement I made at that point was a realization as I was developing this talk around fantasy and literary lots and kind of my own journey was that, you know what, some people's fantasies like this registry, like these ideas of isolation and separation, these fantasies are other people's nightmares. You know, like that registry is a nightmare for me and my family and people I care about. And it's a very gray and thin line, right, between dream and fantasy and imagination and reality. And that's why these things jar us. Like, well, that doesn't make any sense, but wait, could it happen? Right? We're looking kind of like two-faced at the same time. Like, oh, it can't be happening. Oh my God, it's happening. And so we have to be very vigilant about the narrative. We have to be very vigilant at kind of asking the question, right? Like, okay, well, what does this look like? And what if it does happen? And who's there? And I think we have to realize that the things we create have impact. You know, kind of like we open the conversation. We create these structures. We create these institutions. We create these rules by which we live, right? And so we have an opportunity to make those equitable, to make those embrace kind of our best selves and connect us, or we can have them be built out of like fear and isolation and a desire for power and separation. And those things won't last because they can't. I think people need each other. I think people realize that there's very little difference between us when it comes down to it. And that's what I'm going to hope for.
I hope for it too. I love that you were willing to share that, because separation cannot last. So I think that when we focus on kindness and oneness, that will prevail, because I think that's what most people want. They just don't realize that some of the things that are fantasizing are about separation. But people at their heart are good, and that's what I'm sticking with, and I know you are too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really very interesting to me, having grown up in the Midwest. I went to college in Boston. You know, I lived abroad. I've traveled. I came back and kind of have done my adult work again in the Midwest, kind of Rust Belt states. And then, you know, there's all these conversations about the bubble, you know, like, oh, these elitist liberal bubbles, and then these rural middle America bubbles, and that they don't connect. And, you know, maybe that's our job. And I understand people in a small town or a mid-sized industrial town in the middle of America that's worried about their jobs and where they're going to get work and feeding their family. And they're not necessarily asking for a lot. And I think others aren't asking for a lot either when they say, well, I would like my marriage to be recognized to my same-sex partner, or I would like my religion to be recognized and not, you know, considered something bad. And I want healthcare. Like, each of these things doesn't seem to me to have to be mutually exclusive.
I agree. It doesn't. And I think it's up to people like you and me and everybody listening to make sure that they aren't, because I don't believe that they have to be. So I want people to be able to find you. So where is the best place for them to get to you?
Right now I'm working on kind of a new version of my website, but you can find me at strategicurban.com. That's my website. And you can email me my first initial K, my last name R-A, Z as in zebra, V as in Victor, I, at strategicurban.com.
Perfect. Okay, so one last question.
Yeah.
Here it is. What is the one piece of advice that you would give anyone else in the midst of changing a life story?
Oh, wow. I feel like I'm still in the process. Every year there's some kind of new hurdle I get. I feel like, wait, I thought I was on my right life story. I'm still working on it.
I think that's what we always do. We're working on rewriting the life story. Otherwise, we're stagnant and we're not in imagination, that's for sure.
Yeah. I guess I would say for anyone, you know, working on changing their life story, or, you know, who are open to kind of being reflective about, like, hey, is this my story, or am I living someone else's story, right? Because they're actually two different questions. And I think that I would say is to be kind to yourself, and I think is to really try to recognize, you know, which of these things that you're taking as part of your narrative and your story are those that are the authentic you. And which ones are the ones you can shed so that they don't weigh you down. And I think that that's a process. You know, for me, I did grow up in this wonderful big Muslim family, and that had a lot of great things, and it did also have a lot of anchors that some of them, you know, I chose to let go of. And then, you know, being someone who got, you know, multiple degrees and wanted to work and make a difference, but also being an effective mother, and it's so hard. It's like, my gosh, yeah, how can somebody do it all? You have to be fit and healthy and have great kids and smart kids and look good and do social good and X, Y, and Z. And it's too much of a story for any one person to have. And, you know, for me, I've just been continually trying to find those things that are me, those things that, you know, resonate the most with me, those things that I feel I can offer, and try to put them out there without being afraid. And it's a process, and it's a process that is, you know, just because you do something once doesn't kind of make you overcome that fear. You have to do it again and again and again, and it's taxing. And so you have to kind of be kind as you to yourself as you look for, you know, those authentic pieces of your story.
Wow. What, that's beautiful. And I love that we've we have circled around the word kind the whole time, that is really what we're talking about, is being kind to ourselves and being kind to others. So it was just so wonderful to get a chance to talk to you. And I'm delighted that you allowed me to share you with other people.
Thanks for asking me. It's a super privilege to do it. It's been super fun. And I'm just going to try to keep kind of doing what I'm doing. And so I really appreciate you reaching out. Sometimes we need others to hold up a little mirror or a little reflection of ourselves that we might not get, or we might pass over in our kind of continued, you know, moving forward. And so I really appreciate that, because it will help me as well. So I have a lot of gratitude for you for doing this, and thank you for asking me.
Oh, thank you. I love that mirror idea. Thank you so much.
Not all fantasy is good, especially when it leads to separation and the belief that one religion, nationality, color, or gender is not as good as another. Let's imagine towards good. Let's make our what if about unifying, understanding, and expanding good for all. Find more about Kozer on our show notes at theshift.com/podcast, or look for episode 83. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen. Help other people subscribe. And if you haven't yet, come join the Shift the Story Facebook group and let's talk shift. Till next time, let's shift the story together.